From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, we learn about the secrets of spider webs.
So when people say spiders weave silk, I mean, that is just the perfect word. They really are weaving, and they're taking a little bit of this silk A and silk B and mixing it all together.
Then, although Halloween may not bring out ghosts, it can still be a great time to tour Milwaukee's most haunted places.
I don't really know that spirits are on the same calendar that we are, so I think it's a good time for us because we're hunkering down and we have, you know, all of those cultural things that are happening that make us feel spooky.
Plus, a look at Harry Houdini's Wisconsin roots and how he became one of the first international celebrities. Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Spiders are amazing creatures. Now, before you shudder at the word and run away from the radio screaming, just hear us out for a sec. Spiders can catch things we don't like aphids, mosquitoes, and flies. If you leave them alone, they'll happily eat all of the insects in your home. But their appetite for bugs isn't the only reason Dr. Cheryl Hayashi finds them fascinating. Hayashi is the Leon Hess Director of Comparative Biology Research at the American Museum of Natural History in New York City. She specializes in spiders, primarily researching their silk. Actually, it's silks. It turns out some spiders can make more than one, depending on what they need the silk to do for them. Dr. Hayashi will give the Science on Tap lecture this Thursday evening at the Milwaukee Public Museum on the secrets of spider webs. She joined Lake Effect's Bonnie North via Skype from her office in New York to explain why spider silks are such a big deal.
Most people know that spiders, you know, make silk. You know, you kind of see silk here and there, whether or not you're looking for it. You know, it's in your yard, it's in your garage, little corners of your windows. But what's super cool about spider silk is that it's not just one thing. There's many kinds of spider silks. And that's what I want to get across to people. Why spiders have so many silks, what the different kinds of silks do, and their amazing properties.
So any individual spider species has many different kinds of silks?
Every spider species has at least one kind of silk. Most spider species have multiple kinds of silks, but there are some species that make just one kind of all-purpose silk. I kind of call that like the duct tape silks. You know, if you got one, it's going to be a multi-purpose tool. But in many species, they've really specialized their silk. So they don't have just one kind of silk. They have many kinds of silks. For example, orb web weaving spiders, which that's the kind of spider that makes, you know, like the round wagon wheel shaped webs that you might see in your yards. Those spiders have seven different kinds of silks.
Seven. Wow. Okay, so are those seven silks in that web that you would see in your yard, is that just one of the seven?
Well, in a web, in a typical web, you might see about six different kinds of silks go into making that web. The seventh silk is actually used to make a tough outer coating on egg sacs. So that may not be actually in the web. It may be off to the side if a female spider has, you know, laid her eggs for the season. But in constructing the web and in making a capture web, yeah, like six different kinds of silks would have been used, and they would have been used in some places singly and in other places in different combinations. So when people say spiders weave silk, I mean, that is just the perfect word. They really are weaving, and they're taking a little bit of this silk A and silk B and mixing it all together.
So in an evolutionary idea, why would they have evolved to have these seven different kinds of silks, this particular kind of spider? I know there are many different kinds of spiders, but let's just keep it to the orb spider for this moment.
Yes.
You know, what does that do for them in evolutionary terms?
Well, in evolutionary terms, it means that there's been natural selection to have a particular kind of silk that's very good at doing a particular function. And so it allows spiders to have really, you could think of it as like a toolkit to do a variety of purposes. So let's going back to the orb web. The function of the orb web is to catch prey, specifically flying aerial prey, insects, flying insects. And the best way to do that would be to make a web that's made up of a different number of materials, and each of those materials would be a different type of silk. And just like think about when you build a house or you build a car, you're going to use different kinds of materials for the different parts of your house or your car.
One of the things I think that fascinates me as a non-scientist about silk is its tensile strength. Is it true that it's one of the strongest materials of its kind in the universe that we know of?
Yeah, that's not an understatement. So it's not true for all spiders and all silks, but there certainly are spiders that make particular silks with strengths that rival high tensile steel. And certainly if you talk about this property called toughness, which is the amount of energy that a material can absorb before it fails, many spider silks are remarkably just really like off the charts tough. And it is better than almost anything else that has evolved or that man can make.
How did you get interested in spiders and the silk specifically?
I got interested in spiders when I was in college. And it was through, you know, doing research in a professor's lab. And that was just really, really important that, you know, I had the opportunity to get involved with research. And one of the parts of getting involved with research was to feed the animal colony. And so the animal colony turned out to be a spider colony.
Interesting.
And that's how I got started. And, you know, just when I started working with spiders, you know, I hadn't been particularly afraid of them, but I wasn't like I was, you know, particularly like fanatical about them. But just the experience of, you know, day in and day out, working with them, making observations, it made all my classes and just what I was thinking about, it just kind of like distilled down to a system that I could look at and start asking questions about. And then finding out that, wow, there's a lot that's not known about how spiders use silk and make silk.
What are some of the things that we have learned about it recently that we didn't know before? Particularly, I'm thinking of the making it. It seems like it's one of those things that they can make as needed.
So like in the lab, I can, you know, take a spider and I can start reeling. So like, you know, basically hold the spider and pull out drag line silk with my fingers. And I can wrap that drag line silk around a little spindle. And I could really, you know, roll out about, meter after meter after meter after meter. I mean, pretty much until I get bored doing it. And it's amazing. The spider, you know, I can easily go 50, 100 meters. And the spider is just doing it. And it's really hard to really convey, like, just how remarkable that phenomenon is. Because inside the spider, the silk is liquid. So inside the spider, it's not like there's spools of thread in there. It's liquid. And as I'm pulling it out, you know, it's really like, you know, pulling out, going from liquid to this fiber. It's a phenomenal process, and it's happening in real time, near instantaneously. Or just think about, you know, that spider dropping down from a branch all, you know, to the ground, or you see a spider dangling from, you know, your window outside, you know, to your patio. That is all happening in real time. It's possibly, you know, the fastest transformation, or definitely one of the fastest transformations of liquid to solid protein there is. There's nothing in our bodies that can do that.
No, I was going to say we probably would have harnessed it by now if
yeah,
we could
literally make a harness out of it.
Yeah, and literally, yeah. And so, you know, when we think of silks, I think if we're thinking about it at all, we're thinking about silkworms, and we're thinking about the fabric that makes. And is there a reason why we have not done that with spider silk?
Well, with silkworms, there's, you know, this whole thousands and thousands and thousands of years of, you know, the Silk Road and all the development of the domestication of silkworms. So let me just back up a little bit and explain that silkworms, silkworm silk and spider silk, that those are examples of what we call convergent evolution. So it's different species have independently evolved very similar solutions to a challenge. So for silkworms, they make this protein in their salivary glands that they then spin into a fiber, and they use that fiber to make a cocoon to wrap around themselves while they're going through that transformation of, you know, a caterpillar to a moth. Mm-hmm. And so that's coming out of their mouth. And for spiders, they have these silk glands in their abdomen, and they use those silks for a variety of purposes, from basically, you know, when they hatch all the way through their juvenile stages to when they're adults for a spider to reproduce. So it's used throughout their life. And so, you know, one species, it comes out of the mouth, and other species, it's coming out of their abdomen. And so that's convergent evolution. And a huge difference between them is that silkworms, they're basically vegetarians. So they're very easy to have domesticated and mass rear by thousands, millions, really. You could, you know, have a farm that you can just raise silkworms. You feed them mulberry leaves, or you could make some sort of, you know, artificial diet, and they'll happily just eat silkworm chow. While spiders are predatory. And that's a huge difference. That means spiders require live food. You have to feed them live prey. And so it makes it very challenging if you want to mass rear them. Also, because most spider species make more than one kind of silk, it becomes challenging if you want to, you know, let's say sell or, you know, harvest mass quantities of just dragline silk. But how do you be sure you're getting just dragline silk when that spider can make seven different kinds of silks, as an example?
Yeah, that makes sense. Because I was thinking, with its tensile strength and, you know, and the toughness that you were talking about earlier, that you'd think we'd have tried to figure out how to mass produce that in some way. But now I understand why it would be difficult.
Yes, it'd be hard to do it just in spiders. So if you were to just rear spiders, you know, would be very, very labor intensive, and it all just becomes really prohibitive, like the amount of space you need. You have to rear food of all the different insects of all different sizes to feed to spiders of all different sizes. And then how are you going to, you know, collect the correct silk from that spider. But the approach then is you could take a spider silk gene, and if you could move it, if you could insert that gene into a plant or a bacteria culture, some sort of host organism, that's a lot easier to maintain. And that's been the strategy that biotechnologists have taken to want to mass produce spider silk. So you move it to a host organism that's not a predator, and you just put one silk gene in them.
And has that worked?
Yes, that's been working. So there are labs around the world that have successfully done this. So, and they've done it both on kind of a small scale, and they've also done it on, you know, larger scales. So you can just put the silk gene in bacteria, the bacteria grow and express the protein, and then researcher would have to, you know, purify the silk protein out of the bacterial culture. Another approach has been to put the spider silk gene actually into silkworms. So there's, you know, DNA technologies now where you can actually put a spider silk gene into a transgenic silkworm and have the silkworm not only make the spider silk protein, but actually also spin it into their cocoon silk.
Wow.
That's super cool.
That is super cool. Wow. It's almost a Frankenstein monster kind of cool, you know? It's like,
yeah,
we're creating like silkworm spiders. Oh, no.
Exactly. And perhaps, you know, the most famous host of making this artificial spider silk has been a herd of goats that are currently at Utah State, where spider silk genes have been inserted into those goats in a way that the silk gene is expressed in the goat's mammary glands. So that means mama goats can be milked.
Wow.
And there'll be some silk protein mixed into their milk.
And then you can extract it from the milk.
Exactly.
we're talking about all this really cool stuff, and I said earlier that I think spiders are very cool, but I know sometimes I'm in the minority that a lot of people have a very atavistic reaction to either spiders or snakes or both. You know, they're just like, ugh. What is some of the things that you, when you talk to people, like you're coming here to talk to a general audience, what are some of the things you tell them or try to reassure them about spiders so that they can maybe work against that reaction of like, ooh, I have to kill it?
One of the things that people, you know, should be aware of is that we are not in the repertoire of prey for any spider. There is no spider that's hunting people. And so whenever the unfortunate, you know, human spider bites happen, it's because the spider is being defensive. And so I think if people realize that the spider is being defensive, the spider is trying to protect itself because it's feeling threatened by you, or you didn't know the spider was there, you know, underneath a shelf, and, you know, you reached your hands under into that dark area and you didn't know, and that the spider is not out to get you. I think that's something that, you know, people have to kind of realize and understand that. And, you know, I collect spiders all the time, and in my experience, the spiders are afraid of me.
Well, I'm one of those people that, you know, if I find a spider indoors, you know, I will take them out. You know,
yes.
I capture
yeah.
them on a piece of paper or something, and I take them outside so they have at least a chance of catching something to eat.
Or finding a mate, because many of the spiders in our homes are going to be males that are wandering around looking for a mate. And yes, when people see like spiders that are routinely in there around them, you know, remember they're not plants. They don't photosynthesize. They're getting energy from somewhere, and they're a predator, so there's something to eat.
Right, and it's usually something you don't want in your house.
Yeah, or yeah you're not able to catch yourself.
Right,
so they're doing you a favor.
Exactly. Well, Dr. Hayashi, I want to thank you so much for taking time to talk with us today. We're really looking forward to the presentation at the Milwaukee Public Museum when you're here. And thanks so much.
Oh, thank you. It's been fun.
Dr. Cheryl Hayashi is a curator, professor, and Leon Hess Director of Comparative Biology Research at the American Museum of Natural History in New York City. She'll be giving the Science on Tap lecture on the secrets of spiderwebs this Thursday evening at the Milwaukee Public Museum. There's more information at WUWM.com.
Spiders in the night, come around today.
We'll take a quick break, then Anna Lardinoy from Gothic Milwaukee talks about the most haunted spaces in downtown Milwaukee. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. It's believed that Halloween stemmed from a variety of European cultures, a mix of Christian and pagan traditions where the spirits of the dead roam the earth. Halloween has evolved over the centuries, but it's still a time when many choose to reconnect with the spiritual world. That's where Anna Lardinoy comes in. She's the owner of Gothic Milwaukee, and she guides historical ghost tours through the city. She wrote about some of her favorite haunts in this month's Milwaukee Magazine, and she joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about her work and what defines a ghost tour.
The focus is on the supernatural connections to the locations. So on a regular city tour, let's say you would talk about the Pfister Hotel as being one of our most elegant establishments, built in 1893, and maybe a bit about the Pfister family and how they helped shape Milwaukee. And to that, I'll add some of the exciting supernatural happenings on this historic property, like the connection that the hotel has with Major League Baseball players, or perhaps sightings that people claim to have made of Charles Pfister. So that's usually not included on a traditional history tour.
You know, you just mentioned the Pfister, and you have a scooter tour, of course, of Milwaukee's haunted areas. Which neighborhoods do you look at?
Well, I love downtown because it's the most deeply historic part of our city, and I find that really interesting. So I tend to focus there because there is a lot of history and there's already so many great stories. But in my estimation, there are supernatural stories anywhere that there have ever been people.
So, you know, looking at downtown and the tour specifically, what are some of your favorite destinations?
Well, Wisconsin Avenue is the tour that I created for Milwaukee Magazine, and we really focus on that heart of our original downtown. And we don't quite cover everything that's on Wisconsin Avenue, but there are so many great stories. On the tour that I'm giving on the 27th for Milwaukee Magazine, we're going to do a deep dive into the Marquette campus because there are so many great stories on the Marquette campus. If you believe the legend that it was at one time a Native American burial ground, you can find stories with that. At one time, it was truly part of our Milwaukee's historic graveyards, and not maybe all of those plots were removed and replaced a forest home. And then you have an interesting repurposing of buildings that lends to some great stories, like the children's hospital that is now a dorm. So many great stories down there. And it's a really fun way to connect with our history, along with being really entertained.
One of the spaces that stuck out to me on Marquette's campus is the St. Joan of Arc Chapel.
It is truly one of my very favorite things. Even if you don't like things that are spooktacular, this is probably my top three pick of any place to see in Milwaukee because it's just so amazing. Who would have guessed that we in Milwaukee would have this amazing chapel from France here, rebuilt stone by stone in our city? And the reason it's called St. Joan of Arc Chapel is because the woman who bought it and had it taken apart and brought to New York originally on her estate was a devotee of St. Joan. And it is, legend says, that St. Joan actually prayed in this church. And she also purchased a relic, a stone that it said that St. Joan knelt on and prayed. And she had that stone placed into this ancient historic chapel. And now they say that if you touch that stone, it's measurably cooler than all the stones around it. But even if you're not intrigued by that story, the physical building is so beautiful, and it feels very mystical and spiritual. When you walk in, you get the sense of how much people have evolved in a relatively short amount of time because the doorways are quite narrow for modern standards. Things are low, and the stained glass window in there is so incredibly beautiful that it's not hard to understand how the idea of spirituality and magic and all of those things got mixed together. Because I think about people from the 1500s looking at that window and getting lost in the magic of the most colorful thing that they've ever seen. And I can see how people get swept away in that mysticism. It's just a really neat experience. I recommend it for anyone, regardless of how you feel about spooky things.
Another one of the places that's on Marquette campus is Humphrey Hall. Is that the dormitory? Humphrey Hall.
It is. And that is the sighting of so many mysterious things. At one time, it was the children's hospital. So throughout the generations, people have claimed to see tiny patients still lingering there who are very playful and come out sometimes at night to interact with the dorm dwellers. And so we'll talk about those definitely on the tour.
As you said, the tour goes along Wisconsin Avenue, which mm-hmm. is a very historic street just in Milwaukee.
Absolutely.
In general. And one of the places you have is the Ambassador Hotel, which, you know, it's this old Art Deco hotel, and I think a lot of people know it for that reason. But it also has a pretty dark history, pretty modern dark history.
Yes, I have to say that I really struggled with including this on the list because all of my work really focuses on things that happened generations ago. But the mystique is so strong with the ambassador, it felt dishonest to not include it. So I'm going to be covering it in the most respectful way. But the reason that it has such national prominence is because of its association with Jeffrey Dahmer. And you may know that he committed some murders in the hotel, and that's part of his legend and hard to escape that connection with the hotel.
We should say, of course, that this was very recent in a lot of ways.
Right, in the 1990s.
Yeah, and it's a difficult topic to cover, but, you know, in your position, it's also difficult to not cover.
Right. My hope is that it certainly doesn't glorify it and definitely respects the victims of this terrible tragedy. Because this is a terrible story, unlike the story connected with the Pabst Mansion, which is really quite lovely. It is just Frederick Pabst, the proud homeowner, who is still looking over his castle. That's a wonderful story. And that is a fun story to experience. And in many ways, the ambassador is a horrible story and difficult to deal with. And so hopefully I'll do it with the respect that it deserves.
Well, and so many of the ghost stories are something that's pretty light. I mean, you talked about the Pfister in the first part of our conversation. And you know, Mr. Pfister going along the halls, that seems like a good one.
Those are really my favorite stories, to be honest with you, because who doesn't love a benevolent ghost? And also because it's a great way for me to let people connect with our history in a fairly innocent way. But then there are some of these stories that are quite a bit darker. And I really do try to honor and respect the victims, like the stories of City Hall, which most of them are legendary because of the number of suicides, which is a horrible thing and certainly don't want to glorify that. But it's definitely a part of our history. And it's hard not to acknowledge that if you're looking at the dark part of history in Milwaukee.
Well, and one of the places that comes up is the Rave / Eagles Club. And of course, that has a fairly dark history in some ways. It also has a very light history. I did a piece a while back about its kind of racist legacy.
I remember.
Yeah.
The only thing it's haunted by is the spirit of racism.
Is the spirit of racism.
People feel very strongly about that building being haunted. For the book, I went through a number of the stories that surround it. And I definitely didn't debunk them, but I kind of pointed out some logical loopholes in those stories. But there was definitely a young man who died in that pool. That is a true story. The band of kind of evil children has a much more mysterious origin because there's never been a group of children who have died in the building. But yet those stories definitely persist, and people love that. And they're still seeing connections. There are bands from all over the country that have claimed to have supernatural experiences there. And as far as my website, my articles on the Rave are by far my top read things. And I posted them years ago, and they still get hits every single day. So people cannot get enough of the story of the Rave. So I'm excited to share that with them.
You know, as an aficionado in all things ghost and haunted, is Halloween a particularly good time for these kinds of spooky endeavors?
Well, I don't really know that spirits are on the same calendar that we are. So I think it's a good time for us because we're hunkering down and we have, you know, all of those cultural things that are happening that make us feel spooky. But I'm pretty sure that spirits are around all the time if they choose to be around. But it certainly is a lot of fun, and I definitely enjoy it. And I also love candy corn. So this is a win-win for me.
Great time, yeah. Well, Ada, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Oh, I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Anna Lardinoy is the owner of Gothic Milwaukee, which guides haunted historical tours through the city. Her work was featured in this month's Milwaukee magazine, and she'll be guiding a special tour for the magazine on Sunday, October 27th. Lardinoy is also the author of Milwaukee Ghosts and Legends, and you can also find our conversation about that at WUWM.com. We'll take one last break, then learn about the man, the myth, the Wisconsinite, Harry Houdini. Lake Effect returns in a moment, here on WUWM. Like Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Although Harry Houdini died nearly a century ago, the famed illusionist and stunt performer is still a household name. Myths and legends have become such an integral part of his life story that it can be difficult to figure out fact from fiction. But we do know this. For much of his childhood, Houdini was a Wisconsinite. Born Eric Weiss in Budapest, then Austria-Hungary, he was still a young kid when his family came to the state. And that's where Lake Effect's Joy Powers picks up the story with Glenn Gerard and Ellie Gettinger. Gerard is a local Houdini historian, and Ellie Gettinger is the curator of the exhibit Inescapable, The Life and Legacy of Harry Houdini, now on display at the Jewish Museum, Milwaukee.
Houdini's dad was a rabbi, and he was ordained in what would be like kind of the Reform Jewish movement in Hungary. There are a number of myths, and I think one of the challenging things about presenting a Houdini exhibit is anytime you think you're standing on, like, dry ground, you realize, oh, wait, there's all of this other myth underneath there. So one of the stories of why the family comes to the United States is that Houdini's father had murdered a nobleman in Hungary, and he had to flee, leaving behind his wife and five children, and then they came a little while later after he had secured a job in Appleton. But I think this is one of those places where you're like, maybe that's true, or maybe he just came to America for a better way of life. So this has been the challenge in working on this exhibit. And I know for Glenn, who is like has done a significant amount of research, that you find things about Houdini and you're like, wow, that's a really cool story. And you're like, but is it true? Maybe it's true. Maybe not. Who knows?
Right. I've heard that story as well. And it was part of a duel. They were going to have a sword fight. Apparently, Houdini's father and this nobleman, who I think was a count or something like that, and they were going to have a duel and something went wrong and he accidentally mortally wounded the nobleman and then he fled to America. So I don't know. It sounds very similar to the old Kung Fu series TV show to me. kind of a myth or a story. Yep.
The fighting rabbi.
Right,
right. The fighting rabbi.
So they end up in Appleton. And I think for a lot of people outside of Wisconsin, they may not know that Harry Houdini does have this big connection, actually, to the state of Wisconsin.
Right, right. Well, first, the family lived in Appleton. And then about the time he was 8 or 9 years old, he moved to Milwaukee. And the family lived here for quite a long time until he was about maybe 16 years old or so.
During that time, what were they doing in Wisconsin?
Rabbi Meyer Samuel Weiss was the rabbi in Appleton. So that was the first 4 years they're there. They're fairly successful. I know they have a maid, you know, that they have a pretty comfortable life in Appleton. And then this is another place where kind of legend intersperses with history. His father is removed from this position. The kind of working, long-held theory on this is that his father was either seen as being too old world for the Appleton community, or he was seen as being too German, like he couldn't speak English. The person who replaced him, though, also couldn't speak English. So some new theories have emerged that maybe his father was displaced because he was Hungarian and not German, and the majority of that community was from Germany, and they wanted someone who was like them. One of the congregants is actually a future mayor of Appleton, who is the president at the time. So there's also a sense that maybe Houdini's dad and this guy, maybe they weren't quite dueling, but they weren't on the best plane with each other. And so they come to Milwaukee, you know, and he's an itinerant rabbi looking for a job.
When does Houdini start to get into performance? When does that begin?
You know, in my estimate, it was probably when he was 9 or 10 years old, and there was a lot of like interesting things going on in Milwaukee at the time. Where they lived was the old Haymarket, what they call the Haymarket area, which is right around MATC or the Pabst Brewery. There's several addresses, but they all seem to be in that neighborhood. One of the very interesting things that was going on at the time, back in the day before there was motion pictures, was a form of entertainment called a cyclorama. It was almost like an old-time version of an IMAX movie. You would walk into a theater, and there was a moving background and characters that were mannequins that moved, and they would recreate like the Battle of Gettysburg or something on that order, and it was just like a giant moving diorama. The factory where they built these, where the artisans built these, was right in his neighborhood. So that's one of the things I thought was always kind of neat. There was street performers that he befriended. There was a contortionist that he became friends with, circus performers. He saw his first magic show at a dime museum, and a dime museum was a type of a theatrical venue where they may have sideshow acts or different forms of entertainment. They'd have lectures, all kinds of things back in the day. And the first magician he saw was a performer named Dr. Lin, and Dr. Lin performed an illusion where he took a man from the audience and supposedly would amputate his arms and his legs. And it was done in a comical fashion.
He was called the Bloodless Vivisectionist.
Right, yes, yes.
And great title.
I think it was done in a comical fashion. It wasn't done in a serious manner. However, young Eric Weiss, at the time his name was Eric Weiss, he was so intrigued with this that he started to pursue magic and escapes.
And he also, in this time in Milwaukee, the family is really struggling economically. In 4 or 5 years, they had been in 5 different addresses, showing that this is a family in crisis. Rabbi Weiss never gets a steady job here. He actually travels as far as Louisville just to give sermons. So Eric and his brothers start doing things to support the family. They deliver papers for the journal. In fact, he always claimed he delivered the very first edition of the journal. They are bike messengers. They are shoe shine boys. They're errand boys. They work at the Plankinton Hotel. And I think also he starts discovering in this realm of entrepreneurship, you know, all of these kind of low-level jobs, that he, in performing and taking on tricks and doing some form of entertainment, he gets better tips and people respond to him and he engages them in some way or another. And so I think, while it's not an official performance, like, this is kind of one entree into that performing universe as well.
Right. I had heard he did some tightrope walking or something like that. I thought, I believe I read that somewhere. He was involved in some circus acts as well when
so
he was young,
hard.
9,
it's
10
like
years old. He was also a boxer. Mm-hmm. And in boxing, again, it's a sport, but it's an exhibition. It's show business. He was involved in boxing. You know, the dime museum where he saw the magician was right over here on Wisconsin Avenue, about a block away. It was called Jacob Litt's Dime Museum, and that's where it's believed he saw his first magic performance.
So when do we start to see the character of Harry Houdini really emerge as this figure in, you know, the magician's world?
Well, you know, I know his first performances, early performances, were probably at places like a dime museum.
He was called King of the Dime Museum at some point. Harry, they called him Dime Museum Harry. He hated that nickname.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because, I mean, what does it say? If you're Dime Museum Harry, it means you're not really getting any great bookings. You're in the Dime Museum.
That was probably a notch below vaudeville or at the time. I know that he worked in the circus for some time. There's a local story that the fellow who started Master Lock, Harry Soroff, knew Houdini from his time in the circus. So that's another local story. Eventually, he graduated. He started out, as far as I know, doing more standard magic. He was a very good card manipulator, very good with sleight of hand with cards. I don't think he invented escapes, but I think he saw the merit in escapes, and he decided to gravitate toward that at one point.
Would you also say maybe he took it to the next level?
Mm-hmm, yes.
I think one of the things that really his big break comes from handcuff escapes in particular. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that he uniquely did in the world of magic was say, oh, here is this new technology, handcuffs, straight jackets, later on water torture cell, you know, all of these things. And I'm going to make this thing that seems totally improbable to escape from that has just newly captured the public's imagination, and I'm going to perfect that, and it's mine. The handcuff one, actually, he had all of these imitators who started also claiming to be Handcuff King. That was one of his many titles, and he would go in disguise to their performances, and then he would challenge them to break out of handcuffs that he knew were impossible. And when they couldn't, he would say, "That's right, because I am the handcuff king." You know, like, that is how, like, sensitive he was and how performing.
That's a great showman, right?
Yeah. And I think that you start getting that kind of sense of performance early on. But really, the act starts growing when he's, like, 16 or so. He's working at a necktie company in New York. And he reads this biography of this guy, Robert Houdin. And that's where the name comes from, actually. He and his friend at this necktie cutter place decide, no, we're going to go into business. We're going to be like Houdin, and we'll be like Houdin, Houdini. So at first he tours with this friend, the brothers Houdini. Then he tours for a little while with his actual brother, Theo, or Dash, who later changes his name to Hardin. And then once he meets his wife, the rest of those guys are history. Then it's all about Bess, and she's
right,
his partner
right.
for life in terms of if he's performing with someone, it's with her.
Just to take a step back, how did he get from Milwaukee to New York?
So the family is not doing well here, and they actually moved to New York. And one of the things that we document that we found at the UWM Goldemeyer Libraries here, which is a super cool document that I'm so excited that we get to have in this exhibit, is a ledger from the Hebrew Relief Society. The Hebrew Relief Society is the oldest Jewish nonprofit in town, and it still operates today as Jewish Family Services. And it is a ledger that shows the monies that they are giving out. And you can see in two different times, I think it's 1876 and 1878, Mrs. S.M. Weiss has collected a half a ton of coal and $3 from the Hebrew Relief Society. So this is a family that is requiring, you know, actual assistance in order to subsist. And they move to New York. First, Rabbi Weiss moves just to find some sort of job. He ends up also working in this necktie cutting factory. There's a kind of epic Harry Houdini story where you have Rabbi Weiss gathering. In Harry's popular imagination, it's just him. Even though he's like the third or fourth son, but it's just him. And his father says to him, "You will support your mother." And he's like, "Of course, I will never not support my mother. I will always." And from then on, he's kind of tasked with being the family's provider, even though he's like a 16-year-old kid. And he really does support his mother until her death. That is incredibly important to him. His father dies pretty soon thereafter.
So, you know, you mentioned how he gets his name, how he ends up touring or beginning to tour with this. But something that you said in the exhibit is he's really the first international superstar. What does that look like at that time? What does that mean?
He really was. He was like the first Elvis, the first superstar, rock star. There were people out doing escapes and people out doing magic. But one thing he did that other people weren't doing is he would challenge people to lock him up in different devices mm-hmm. and things, and he would escape from them. So a couple of things he did that were just genius. He did a what you'd call today cross-marketing. He would find a company that built barrels, which were popular back in the time, and he would partner with them and say, "Okay, I tell you what, you guys build a barrel, and I'm going to escape from it." The company would get publicity, and he would get publicity at the same time, which was just brilliant. Nobody was doing that at the time. This is my personal opinion. Being a newsboy, he knew the power of the press since he was 9 years old here in Milwaukee. He knew how important that was to get his name on that newspaper. And that's what carried him through his career, is constantly doing publicity stunts, partnering with companies, and that propelled him to become a celebrity.
Well, and I think also he really perfected that idea of the public being a part of the persona. So he would do performances he'd get paid for, but then he would also have these hugely public escapes where in front of the Milwaukee Journal offices or in front of the Wisconsin State Journal, he would be locked up in a straitjacket and hung upside down from the building. And then 20,000 people would show up in the streets to watch this escape. And then some portion of those people would pay for tickets. But a lot of those people are just, that's their touch with Houdini. You know, so I think he's like a viral celebrity in that way, that if you think about how people have all of these multiple platforms in which they're working today and, you know, they're putting things out and they're making their brand. He was doing that 120 years ago. He certainly would have been a master of all of these different platforms. So when he saw a new technology like film, he's like, okay, I can make movies. Or airplanes, okay, I can be an aviator. He claims to be the first person to have flown across Australia. And he definitely did. I just don't know if he's the first. But I think that that's one of these things that, I'm not saying he's a Kardashian, but he certainly had that same kind of work ethic and, like, how do you synergize a brand? Houdini's going to be on top of that.
As we've talked about, there has always been myth and mystery about so many parts of his life. But I think one that is still in popular legend today is really how he died.
Oh, yeah.
There's so many stories that go around that. But at this point in his life, he is a very well-known figure. He's, as we've talked about, an international superstar. So there must have also been quite a bit of documentation about what happened.
Well, it's such a bizarre story. I think, you know, it's a story that befits Houdini. He's in his dressing room. You know, a kid comes in. He's not actually such a kid. He's like 30.
Right.
But everyone imagines, like, you know, like an 18-year-old upstart. But he's like a 30-year-old dude coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And he's supposedly returning a book to Mr. Houdini. And he comes in and says, Houdini, you can absorb any punch? And he's like, yeah, you know. And then he punches him 4 times. It's a weird thing to do.
Some of your more elementary books about Houdini will say, well, it was a kid punched him in the stomach. I think that's because it was at a university. Mm-hmm. The fellow who did punch Houdini was a student there, but he was an older student.
He's
he was
a med
maybe
student.
In the 30s or early 40s. Houdini was on his crusade against spiritualism, you know, fraudulent spirit mediums at the time. His last couple tours at that time, he did a show which he called a 3-in-1 show, and he had returned to his roots of doing magic again. It was escapes, and then he also would debunk spirit mediums. And spiritualism was a big thing at that time. It was right after World War I, and people believed in it, and they thought they could contact. There were so many people, unfortunately, killed in World War I that families bought into the superstition of, hey, we can contact our son who got killed in World War I. So it was actually a big movement. From what I read, the fellow who did punch Houdini, eventually causing the ruptured appendix and the appendicitis, et cetera, really didn't care for Houdini. He was a supporter of spiritualism. And he, you know, they make it sound like an accident, but there's some accounts that it wasn't just quite an accident either, that the fellow hit Houdini when he wasn't ready. Houdini, being a boxer, would do sort of a strongman stunt where he would tighten up his abdominal muscles and go, hey, go ahead and punch me in the stomach. And Houdini was in very good shape, even in his 50s. And it was kind of a little strongman stunt that he would do. And my take on it is that the fellow went in and said, hey, I heard I can punch you in the stomach as hard as I want. Houdini was relaxing in a chair at the time, reading a newspaper. And Houdini said something effective, yeah, that's a stunt I used to do. And the guy just hauled off and hit him. Mm-hmm. So Houdini was really taken back by it. Like, it was almost like an assault.
And he performed that night.
Right.
You know, the show must go on.
Yes, yeah.
And I think he actually had one more show in between there. And then finally he gets to Detroit. And he's like, this, I can't, I have to. And he finally, 9 days later, goes to the hospital. At this point, his appendix is ruptured, and he dies on Halloween, which only adds to the myth of Houdini.
Right, right. And a little bit of Milwaukee trivia. His doctor, when he passed away, was Dr. Leo Dretzka from Cudahy, of the Dretzka family. Yeah,
that's a good one.
Yeah.
There are all these connections. So one thing that his wife, he had spent the last part of his life debunking spiritualism. He actually appears before Congress in support of a bill to take on mediums and things and fortune tellers, which is an interesting. There actually is a House bill against mediums and fortune tellers that comes up in this period because it was seen as such a big social problem. So they make this agreement that they're going to come up with a way that if anyone can come back, that he will have a code, and he's going to say this code if he comes back. And so for the 10 years after his death on Halloween, Bess Houdini conducts these Houdini seances. And 10 years, no response. So she gives up. She gives up the ghost at this point. She says, 10 years is long enough to wait for any man. which is a great quote. And but people pick this up, and there's still Houdini seances that are going on all over the country. Always an official one. We are having an unofficial seance on Halloween to see where we get. Not feeling very optimistic, but it'll be a really fun night to kind of engage that sense of the Houdini experience and see what that's like, you know, since it's a big part of the legacy now.
Ellie Gettinger is the education director at the Jewish Museum Milwaukee and one of the curators of the museum's current exhibit, Inescapable, The Life and Legacy of Harry Houdini. Glenn Gerard is a local Houdini historian and musician. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and won't you join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect that's right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air is next.